Everyone has some sort of a closet that's become too small. A closet is no place to live, and I want to support as many people as I can in stepping out of that prison into the fullness of life that's waiting for them on the other side of that closet door. I'm Nancy Shadlock from Centered Life Coaching. Join me in listening to these coming out chronicles. Get curious about your story, and then see what good things are waiting for you on the other side of your closet door.
Hi, friends. Welcome back. I'm happy to be here, and I'm riding a high today of having had a conversation with a bunch of people about the mistranslation of the word homosexual in the Bible that happened in 1946. Can you believe that was the first year that it appeared in the Bible? Before that, there was like all these other translations that don't have the same ring to it as what we have here. If you want to hear more about this, it's a film that just has been released, and you can stream it online at 1946themovie.com. I really invite you to, you know, grab a few friends, get your book club, your movie club together, and have a listen and talk about it, because it really shifted culture, and it's time for a reshifting of culture. And if you don't want to watch the whole film, I did interview the director of this film a couple years ago on the podcast here. And so you can scroll back to episode 52 and hear more about the intricacies of that word and how it was mistranslated and what the meaning was before and things. It's pretty cool. I'm happy to be putting out some new episodes. And I've been on a bit of a break because it's been hard. It's hard to just keep putting podcasts out into the void and not know if anyone's listening, not know what's happening. And it's a lot of work, and I don't get paid for any of this. And in fact, sometimes I pay someone to help me do the editing or the posting. And so I've been toying with the idea of creating a Substack membership, because that can be a way that we can create a community that can talk about what comes up in these episodes. It can be a way of giving back if you pay a subscription to be part of it. I'll always, you know, have the episodes free to listen to. But I'm wondering if you who listen regularly, if you'd like to be part of something like that, a community that's a little bit more intentional. It's not social media, so it's easier to go deep and be real and not have trolls listening in. Let me know your thoughts. I'd love to hear from you. Today's episode is really different than some of mine. Like, some of mine can get kind of, you know, heart-feely. This one, we talk, I should count how many times we say the word democratic in it. It's very political in some ways, and really intellectual. And I appreciated so much my guest sharing her views on many different things. And I'm not going to spoil it all for you, but get in there, have a listen, and let me know what comes up for you as you listen. Trigger warning, we do talk about the trans rights issues that have been coming up in Alberta lately. So if you're sick of talking about that, or if that feels too hard to go into right now, take a pause on this one and catch us in the next one. Okay, talk to you soon. Hi, Jackie.
Hello, how are you doing, Nancy?
Good, I'm happy to have you here today.
Well, thank you for the invitation. This is going to be fun.
I think so. I feel like you have a lot of different aspects of coming out stories. And so I'm excited to hear the things that you want to share with us. Of, it sounds like there's some themes of invisibility and coming out as your true self in different contexts and different things. And so I'd love to hear, like, what is, how do you want to share with us about who you are?
Sure. And I think it's a really complex question, actually, more complex than I think we often take it to be. And so I guess one of the things, and you're absolutely right. I think one of the first things that I struggled with the concept of coming out simply because I couldn't put my finger on a specific moment in time. Because I was involved in, even like in my university days at McGill, doing radical democratic thought and critical studies and feminist legal scholarship and reading lesbian feminist scholars and reading critical race scholars who were also lesbian and feminist. And so queer positive thinking as a philosophy of, about how we think about our society and our like our democracy was a part of what I integrated into who I wanted to be and my values, like from age 21. So I was always, in a queer positive lens from that point, albeit straight at the time. And then looking around me and going, I'm open to it. I'm open to like being with women, but I never sort of managed to find any women that I felt attracted to. So then I thought, well, is there something wrong with me? Because I completely believe it's a spectrum, and I believe that you fall in love with the individual, not with the body or the gender that houses that spirit of the individual. But I wasn't, finding women to date that I, resonated with. And so I think it was not until I was like 28 that I actually had that chance to date, and be in that kind of a relationship where I'm like, okay, I found someone who is of the opposite sex. I'm able to understand and experience that piece, not just at a normative, philosophical, political commitment, but that I feel like that's something now that's part of my lived experience. But it wasn't like a coming out, even, like maybe there was some like, oh, I wonder what my parents are gonna say when I bring my girlfriend home. But I didn't worry that they would not accept that because my parents were exceptionally open-minded and knew that I was engaging in pushing the boundaries on everything from a feminist lens already. And I wasn't conforming to any of it, even in what I had been living and that they knew of me. So I didn't feel that that was like a coming out. And I was singing in a queer choir for like 5 years even prior to that. And so again, like people would say, where was your coming out moment? And I would try and figure out what was the moment, and I didn't really have that pithy, aha, this is when it happened. So that's something that I've just sort of experienced over time with the concept and sort of go, and I like how I think you've said to me in the past when I asked you informally about, the title of this podcast, and you're like, well, it's like a series of coming outs, maybe, or self-discoveries over time. And I really think that is so appropriate to understanding, I think, all journeys of like, how do we come into figuring out who we are as human beings, whether, queer, straight, whatever. It is such an unfolding over many years. And so there isn't this like stereotypical one moment, right?
I've started, stopped calling myself a coming out coach, and now it's a coming in coach, because coming into that deeper part of ourselves, and with each layer we go deeper, it's a new coming out.
Totally, 100%. And I was thinking about this, I'm 48, so like fast forward, from, thinking about these issues since I'm like 20, 2021, right? And how do we embrace not only the, feminist pro, queer positive, neurodiversity positive, anti-racist. It's all a part of the academic research and teaching I've been doing for 20 years on these issues in Japan, around Japanese citizenship, but looking at it through also a Canadian citizenship understanding of, feminist legal studies, and intersectional view of identity and individuality. Then I sort of had this like moment where I was nominated last year in 2023 for the, it's called Involve. They did a campaign. Involve is an international organization working on inclusion, and Involve paired up with YouTube, and they do this these awards, I guess. And I was acknowledged as an Involve YouTube campaign, one of the people selected for this global 100 outstanding leaders. And for me, I was an outstanding executive of a company because my small company, Enjoy Japan, KK in Japan. And then I do have Enjoy Innovation Incorporated here in Vancouver just as of last year. I guess I'm one of those few women who are in Japan and who are out on record. And because I mean, honestly, it's not easy to be non-conforming in Japan, full stop, on any issue. But I think it's even harder for women in Japan to be out. And so at any rate, I was awarded this, and I sort of thought, oh, well, so then how do I talk about this again, maybe to put on record and be more visible? I've been working with the Pride Business Alliance Japan to create a chamber of commerce that's queer positive in Japan, because we don't have that yet. We wanted a space for queer positive entrepreneurs, but also queer positive companies who want to think about supplier diversity. And so we're building that activist lens to try and build this chamber. And one of my colleagues nominated me for this award because I was involved in all of that recently. So I sort of thought about, like, oh, maybe I need to be talking about this more again on record again, because I happen to be with a male partner. And I can imagine that in a society where I'm navigating in Japan and not everybody talks about their private lives, a lot of people might just mistakenly assume I'm straight. Like they might not understand that. And so there's an invisibility that comes from that sort of in-between space, where people who don't know you and they don't know my research or academic teaching on these issues, or the advocacy work I do, around disaster risk and, inclusion of LGBTQ families and that I was involved in Japan, they wouldn't know that necessarily about me. So I thought, well, how does this become an opportunity to then reflect on what is my story? And like you put to me, what is the current coming out story, right? Like now at age 48 and with that 2020 hindsight of what I've lived up until now in Japan, how do I bring those learnings forward, not only for the Japanese market and for creating more space in Japan for queer women in particular, but also for the work that I'll be doing in Canada as well to build in Canada again.
And for the legacy of your kids and like creating inclusion that's lasting in
Absolutely.
our world.
Absolutely. And I mean, fundamentally, for me as a, I sort of consider myself a perpetual student of democracy. I mean, perhaps it's naive, but I still actually hold out hope that democratic institutions and democratic law, if we could get great laws, because we have a great constitution in Canada, and if you can execute that and have great laws, and that you can build that out through to our institutions and our public schools and our all of the architecture and social ecosystem and infrastructure of citizenship to be meaningfully, the spirit of equity, democratic equality executed on. I do believe that there is a hope within democracies to build that out in a meaningful way. It does take a lot of time, effort, education, and then building it through our democratic institutions and having accountability and governance oversight of so many different actors in society to make sure that hate is, shut down. But I still
Give
hold
some
hope for that.
examples of what are some examples of what you would hope would come through in beautiful democracy?
Well, I think often I end up speaking, and the reason why I like to do the character foil of looking at Canadian citizenship and Japanese citizenship is in Canadian citizenship, we've sort of had a growing evolution of building the legal architecture and the policy frameworks for inclusion, particularly on LGBTQ recognition. So it's not just enough to decriminalize homophobia and then just leave it to the free market. You have to actually then go in and say, well, what is family law doing? How is family law shutting down space for queer families? Like, are we supporting and giving legal recognition for same-sex marriages and couples and partnerships and their families and their children and how the children have relationships to the different parents in those relationships. In Japan, we have the opposite, whereby family law still will not hold space for non-married couples. And to be married, you have to be heterosexual at the current status of the Japanese family registry. So even straight non-married couples, so man and a woman in a common law relationship in Japan, are not seen as legally a family. With a relationship whereby, and this was some of the work I was doing around in the aftermath of the disaster in Japan, the Great East Japan earthquake, tsunami, and the nuclear disaster, you had all of these different families across the Tohoku northern region, families that are not married, so straight couples that are not married and their children in a household, same-sex couples who are not able to marry legally in families with children. None of them legally having recognition. And therefore, if they go missing in the disaster, if they are killed, if their bodies are not found after the tsunami, those individual survivors left behind in the family cannot get any access to information, period, because you're not family. So the devastating cascading impacts of that from an emotional trauma fallout that builds on top of already a triple disaster that was beyond anything imaginable to scientists globally who work on disaster risk and earthquake. But then to have the social disaster and the political disaster and the emotional trauma layered on top, because now not only is your family going through the fallout of the disaster, but you, if your family member is hospitalized, you can't find out. You don't know where they are. And if they passed and the body's found, you won't be called to identify them and figure out that you'll be allowed to even know that the body was found and where are they. So these are real issues, right? Of family law reform to be recognizing and legally affirming and supporting families is such a the baseline of a democratic society that is taking the individual rights and democratic freedoms of each individual to be equal and to have access to governmental supports and legal support. It obviously had other impacts in terms of just, disaster relief goes to the head of the house in Japan, and they still have a head of household system. So disproportionately going to the male head of household. If you're a two-woman same-sex partnership with children, you're essentially not recognized. It's a single parent with children, and then there's another person who lives at that address who's just like a stranger.
And so what would you want Canada to grow in? Like, it sounds like already it's, leaps and bounds ahead in positive ways, but it sounds like you're wanting more even.
I mean, I think in the Canadian context, we've done a lot to legally make sure we have recognition for diverse families, for same-sex couples, for common law couples, for the children, for reconstituted families. I think we've solved the core issues in a meaningful way. I think there's always more work that we can be doing to reduce homophobia, transphobia, to reduce misinformation that flows in a society. And I think that's about filtering it down even more so in terms of how we do literacy as a society for raising the cultural awareness of all parts of society. I think we do quite well already in terms of what I'm seeing in the schools. And I won't assume that the schools that my children go to here now in Vancouver are representative of all schools across the country. I think that's quite progressive. And maybe there's more work to be done in schools across the country. I think
Yeah,
from my
can
perspective, it's also more like what are the legal and the law reform inspirations in Canada that can be an offering in Japan? And I've been sort of being that bridge trying to say, these are some of the things we do in Canada, and it's going. Society hasn't fallen apart in Canada. Like society works in Canada, and And Canada is a functional democracy despite these different degrees of diversity that we are legally recognizing, affirming, carving out space and support and services for. Japan, Japanese leaders, Japanese parliamentarians, and having those conversations with them about what is working in Canada and why it's working. It's kind of an offering to say, this is something that Japan can be doing and ideally would be doing because, as a member of the G7, Japan's kind of an outlier constantly on gender equality and on LGBTQ non-recognition legally, among other issues.
Yeah, you mentioned that like of the G7 countries, it's the lowest in gender pay gap. Is that what it?
Well, gender, so the Gender Gap Index is an international World Economic Forum international ranking, and Japan is like 125th. And it's striking, people don't understand that data point because they go, what? Japan is like, you know, a modern democracy, industrialized. They have robots, for heaven's sakes. How can they have such a devastatingly poor? And there's a lot of issues why that is the case. But if we're thinking from an intersectional lens, then women in particular are economically disadvantaged, politically shut down, don't have access to power and authority and influence and voice and agency in the same ways. And then to be queer, to be a queer woman, to be a lesbian woman, to be a trans woman, then you're layering on all that other additional, you know, compounding disadvantage within an already difficult scenario for women to thrive and to be empowered to have agency over their life and to be self-determining.
You talk about being a bridge to Japan and like showing them like, look, Canadian society hasn't shut down because of these things. In some ways, I wonder if you also need to be a bridge to Alberta. Because right now it's, it's very backwards in some ways of just like shutting down smaller and like, can you speak to that? Like, what would you?
Well, and I'm going to ask you to give me a little bit more specific areas where I know you're recently moved there, right? And I've been following the discussions, you know, around gender affirming care, and I've been following, obviously, frankly, the discussions in the United States that we also see on these issues, right? And there's kind of a trickle down that I feel comes across from the American conversations and the sort of very polarized way it plays out in the United States. And that trickles across, and I feel like a lot of it trickles across first and foremost to Alberta. And I'm not
Yeah.
sure why that is,
We call
but.
it like Texas of the North because it's very similar in some ways, like very conservative. And so even in the last little while here, Danielle Smith, our premier, has come out with these
Yes.
new things that she wants to incorporate, where it's, making it a lot more just hard for trans kids. And I had, I've had some really good conversations with my parents and other people who are just like, I don't get it. Like, why shouldn't they? Like, parents should have lots of control for their kids and they shouldn't be getting lured into these different things at school by these teachers and things. And I'm like, I don't know if they're being lured in because
Yeah, you
I
sort
think, but I feel conflicted myself sometimes because it's like, yes, parents should be the main person the kid's talking about this stuff with, but the bottom line is like, be a
What
good
if you
parent
can't? And what
who's
if you
listening to
can't?
your kid and
Right.
like, yeah, so many trans kids don't have that relationship with their parents. And so that's where it's really hard.
And I think that is at the heart of those issues, full stop. And I don't think it's limited to issues around gender affirming care. Like, I think that political view that parents should have control is across a number of issues, right? Parents should have control and should be able to prevent girls from having access to birth control. Parents should be in the room if a girl is wanting to have an abortion, and their parents should have to know about it and give consent. There's a whole range of how we understand the right to self-determine for children who are minors under care till age 18? And where do those boundaries start and stop when parents are perhaps not the ideal supportive, emotionally and morally empowering and present for the children? And what is the role of law and democratic sort of regulatory framework? Is it to give the benefit of the doubt that all parents are angels? Or is the role of the law to say, we need to understand that there's going to be guardrails needed for the vulnerable minor individuals, minor not having attained majority, the teenagers that are facing critical decisions about their life that need to have some agency, and where they're not actually getting any support at home? What do we do in those contexts? And I think, what is the role of the medical profession in those instances? What is the role of mental health professionals who support in the schools as counselors and therapists? Is there access to mental health support and thought partnering and coaching that would be in the best interest of the teenager, first and foremost, to be empowered to make and to have informed consent around what they need for their life, right? And what are the complexities of that in light of, the moral development and the emotional development and the brain development and the bone development of teenagers to becoming to be adults? That's a lot happening in that period. There's a lot going on. So how do we help those teenagers be the best supported possibly? And I think we need guardrails because not all families are ideal. And I
So
think if
what
we're
would a
making,
guardrail be?
I think it's making sure that those teenagers are having access to full information from multiple individuals, adults that are in a relationship of trust with them, multiple sources of information, the medical profession, mental health professionals, parents, other trusted adults, maybe it's teachers in their school. There needs to be a multiplicity of adults who they trust and can get good information to get the full view of what's happening in their lives and how they can be thinking about and supported in navigating that. I think making sure those supports are in place as a part of just well-being is important. And I think the legal frameworks should be supporting that course of action, because how can we expect informed consent when you're not getting all the range of information and you don't have five adults you trust to talk about these difficult issues with? And at most, I think you would need at least hopefully five different perspectives. I mean, there's the medical view, but there's the mental health view. We know there's comorbidities across neurodiversity, gender, queer identity, mental health. And so how do you tease out and just look at one tiny slice and say, oh, it's just this one tiny issue. Let's just talk about that issue. And most professionals, unfortunately, are not always encouraged to do the full interdisciplinary conversation across multiple viewpoints.
I think that's a lot of people. Like, a lot of people are scared to have a different viewpoint and to have their kid have a different viewpoint than what they have, and
Sure.
different than their religion, different than their
Yeah.
whatever. And so it's like,
The pressure is real,
how do we
right?
help people have more comfort with looking at many different viewpoints?
And I think that's the core heart of what democracy is supposed to be equipping citizens to be able to navigate, right? If we can't understand that the core of democracy is not only equal rights and freedoms, that's right. We're all born of equal rights and freedoms and of equal moral value as individuals. That's kind of your working hypothesis of democratic theory and democratic governance and law and constitutionalism. But even more so, democracy is, and democratic government is said to be the least worst form of government, least worst, right? Compared to authoritarianism and all these, other kinds of, government systems, because we carve out space for the rights of minority viewpoints. As a formal part of what it means to be a democracy, we've carved out space for the minority viewpoints because we don't know, and we're not like we're fallible. So those minority viewpoints might actually hold sway and end up being what the majority thinks to be the right course of building a good society together. Maybe if we wait 15 years, that minority view is going to be the view that the majority has a consensus on. But when it's first articulated, it's very much a minority view at the time of that stage of democratization. And so making sure that as a society, we're carving out space and protecting that it's okay to have a minority viewpoint and that you don't become the enemy who is then, attacked and then subjected to hate speech because of your minority view. So how do we balance respect for minority position or minority viewpoints? All the while in Canada, we've been very clear that hate speech is not protected speech because hate speech is anti-democratic if you take equal rights and freedoms to be true, right? So there's the tension constantly in how we
And
balance.
how do you listen to the minority view and not feel threatened?
Not take it personally, not see it as an attack on your own choices for your own, how I live my life and how I self-determine. My sense of how I want to self-actualize is about my business. And as long as there's no negative imposition or violence in, imposed on others, then we have this sort of mutual respect for the right to self-determine of each individual according to the ways they want to pursue the good life. And that respect for different ways of living a life is not easy. I think it's not easy for parents to understand that their children are not going to just become mini-me's, right? Who just like reproduce what their parents thought and that they believe what that father knows best and mother knows best and don't question me on any of that, just think what I think.
Those days are long gone.
Long gone, right? And the parents have gotten it wrong a ton of times, right? The parents have been absolutely wrong in terms of not having understanding of what their kids need. And so it's a real tension, and I feel it both as a political scientist and sort of person who's passionate about law and democracy. And I feel that tension as a parent when I'm going, okay, how am I supporting my kids and being self-determining? Am I like being too present as a guide that I'm not allowing enough space for them to choose and to hear from other viewpoints? And so I'm trying to always think about what are the adults that they could trust? Do I need to put them in contact with so that they'll hear from those trusted adults, not from just,
And not just a trusted adult that would share your viewpoint.
exactly, right? That they at some point need to come to the point of maturity, of freedom of conscience. Like, it's a core to democracy. Freedom of conscience. You can't have freedom of conscience if you've never been exposed to multiple views and then had to make a political choice for yourself about, okay, I've heard it all. Now, what do I think? And what's my freedom of conscience on that topic? What do I consciously and of free conscience feel I can, as my values, want to show up for those values in the way I live my life? And I think that's hard, right? That's a long trajectory of feeling safe emotionally and psychologically, that and having self-confidence to say I heard all the information and I feel that I'm ready to make a decision for my life on how I want to live with my values. That's a lot of work. That's a lot of work for adults, let alone
People are
teenagers.
exhausted and don't want to take the time for that.
And who are tired and who are working, long hours, but also, trying to pay bills, trying to raise kids, trying to do their best, fallible, making mistakes, failing forward constantly. I think parenting is constantly failing forward, right? I feel like parenting and entrepreneurship are just
Totally.
constantly failing forward, right? And trying to do the best you can, with very imperfect conditions and not knowing what you don't know. So we have to, I think, have grace for each other, like huge amounts of grace. And that's where when it becomes a polarized discussion and a really sort of angry emotional response of not being able to see the other person as having like legitimate views that maybe they are on the journey and they're at a different spot in the journey of educating themselves on these different types of things, and that's okay. But that doesn't mean that they're not the enemy. Because in democracy, you can't have enemies. You have everyone is a part of the circle, a part of the society. And how do we figure out that sort of coordination of differing views and still be living in a peaceful context, but having democratic dissent and democratic dialogue to learn from each other?
And maybe that's an answer is like get in small circles, meet up with people, and like find ways where you can have a conversation with someone who has a different viewpoint and hear them out and hear them as a human. And
As a
it gets
human.
so polarized on
Yeah.
the internet. It's so easy to
Oh,
just
for sure.
post stuff and be kind of protected, but it's so mean. And so it's like,
The
how
digital
many real
space.
life conversations can you have? Who can you get to know that's different than you and really hear them?
Exactly. I think because, and this is where the in-person is so different, right? The digital is impersonal and you can hide. And you cannot be accountable for who you are, and you can be mean and you can say things, and it's just like there's no accountability in some senses when it's all online conversations and people are also even using anonymous users. So you don't even know who it is writing. There's
Yeah.
just no transparency of like owning your opinions and owning the meanness. If that's really who you are, then like, I want to know who you are. I want to know who the mean people are who are going to be unkind potentially to me or my children. That's not fair, right? To have people hide who they are and then to engage in that kind of, I think, animosity. So I do think that the in-person matters. And I do think that getting involved to understand a human being who actually lives that experience. And then not discounting what they're going through, you know, to be a teen trying to explore a couple of major things while going through puberty and not knowing what that impact is going to be, and then the impact on the emotional state and your mental health and your body transitions and your changes and learning to gain in life skills. All amidst tremendous peer pressure and pressure from parents and pressure from, you know, there's just so much going on. And it's not, there's no one right way to be a human, right? So the in-person, I agree, is those are the spaces where you actually are communing with each other, hopefully. And hopefully it's a communing, like it's building community. It's also not just, oh, hey, I want to learn about your experience because you're a fetish and I'm curious about you. Can you talk to me about all your personal stuff? Because that's also not respecting boundaries,
Just like
right? Like,
voyeurism.
it's not respectful and it's not an attempt to like be in you know, relationship that's trusting and emotionally safe for both parties.
And I think that's what's hard is like, where are the contexts where we can have those safe conversations and who's curating them? Because if one person's curating them that has a different view than this
Yeah.
person, then do they want to come? And so it's like, and we have less spaces for that, I think, in general now because of COVID, because of where we are in society. Like less people go to church, which, in some ways used to be a place where those things
Yeah.
could happen. Maybe there was community associations, maybe there's, a bar, a coffee shop.
Yeah.
But again, we've become very like, we don't even call people because we don't want to interrupt their lives.
I know, right? It's so fascinating that the old school phone call can be seen as like an
So
imposition,
intrusive, yeah.
right? And so I'm just going to text them instead, and then asynchronously they'll get back to me on their schedule, right? That would be the more sort of, but it's true that then what do you lose when you don't hear the person's voice? And so I've actually taken, I had this horrible accident where I had a torn retina. And last June, I had to be in the hospital for 7 days, lying face down. 7 days.
Heard of
I
this,
mean, I was
yeah.
in a beautiful Red Cross, Northern Nagano, Japan Red Cross hotel, hospital. impeccable care, and so I was well taken care of, so comfortable. And I still had things I needed to answer my Enjoy team on, and I had other things going on for a women's empowerment organization that I lead called Pew Japan, which is for all diverse women living in Japan. And so I had to keep sort of somehow figuring out how to work while being told that I had to be face down and I couldn't use my eyes. I couldn't use the one eye anyhow that was operated, but you didn't want to put strain on the other eye, you know, inevitably as a result. So I would use my phone and I would read and then I would voicemail on Slack to my two teams. And I would voicemail it because Slack builds the transcript automatically. So the other side can both listen to it and hear the nuances of all the detailed stuff that I'm trying to explain, which I couldn't possibly text because it was too many words. But then they could also just skim read the transcript if if you don't have the ability to listen because you're on the train in Japan, you're not in Japan on the train, you don't make any sound. You don't play music loud, you don't talk on the phone, you don't take up space. It's a collective, it's a public space, which means nobody owns it, which means everybody respects that there needs to be quiet and peacefulness to make it bearable for everyone, because particularly in Tokyo, I mean, you can be really jammed in, right? Like really cram you in there. So you can't be having like all of this ambient noise on top of everything. So it's very respectful in the way that the publicness of train space and buses and whatnot. So for people who are in a train commuting, they can't listen to my voicemail, but they can read it. They can read the transcript. But it's interesting, and I started to do more voice. Now I can see, I've healed my eye better, but I still now I'm realizing I'm using the voice messaging because, and I'm using voice to texting because it's faster. Voice to text is so much faster. Because then people are getting the full nuance of what I'm actually trying to say and describe, and then I can do a better job of on voice than I can texting in an instrumentalist text message saying, can you do this and that and the other? And because of this, you don't give context because it'll take too long. And you miss and you drop threads of information they need, or it comes across too direct and there's no like humanity in the way that it's being voice communicated because it's just text and it's
And
kind of
Japanese is
like a
a
bot.
more tonal language too, isn't it? Like where the intonation matters.
I think I don't know that. I mean, to some degree, but not to the
Not like
degree.
China, where if your voice
No.
goes up, it means this thing, and if your voice goes down, it's the same word, but it
There's a
sounds
little bit of
different.
that in Japanese language, but for the most part, it's a very context-based language. So you would know by context which word it is more than the tonality. So I wouldn't say that would be, but just in terms of like the friendliness that comes through in the voice that you don't get when you're reading a text. And the humanity that comes through that the person is not like criticizing you. It's not, you know, this is not a passive aggressive text. This is not like a top down text. This is the person and you hear their voice and it makes it just so different and more, I think, more welcoming and inclusive as a communication style.
Yeah, and you mentioned that Valentine's Day is really big in Japan, and like we're going to try and get this out in time for that. And so what correlation would you want to make from this conversation to that day? And
So a lot of, and I yes there is Valentine. So Japan is interesting the way that they take up a tradition and then they change it, right? To make it localized. And so actually Valentine's Day plays out a little bit differently. But the reason I was saying it's kind of a big important date is because major lawsuits on same-sex marriage went in I want to say 4 years ago, possibly maybe 5 years ago now, and there were three major lawsuits that went in. Arguing that the denial of access to marriage for same-sex couples in Japan was unconstitutional. And three couples at least put in court challenges. And there was a whole media campaign that we built around the lead up to the Valentine's Day submissions of these court challenges. And at the time, actually, LGBTQ activist Gemma Hickey from Newfoundland had traveled to Japan and was working on doing some education and literacy for the media in Japan. And it was a collaboration with the Canadian Embassy in Tokyo. And I was sort of brought into that because I work on those issues as an academic. And in my law reform work around disaster risk governance, the international framework. And so we had this interesting opportunity to do awareness raising at the University of Tokyo and have Gemma speak about their experience. And then the activities around collaborating with the media who follow human rights issues in Japan and are very interested in covering it with progressive and informed opinions. And so the Canadian Embassy is, I think, a real leader in that sense, where they will help Japanese media in some senses and be supportive to say, well, we're bringing in this person. They have these particular views and expertise and lived experience. Would you like to have a session with them to learn directly from their perspectives? So that happened. And then there was Valentine's Day awareness for the media to then be writing on the issue of this court challenge, but having had sort of the introduction to LGBTQ and, gender and trans and non-binary, what do those words mean? How do you use them accurately? And then how do you write about those terms accurately in terms of journalistic reporting so that that doesn't get mis so that it doesn't inadvertently become a misinformation campaign because the media journalists don't have the education and literacy to know how to use and disaggregate which term. And so that was really interesting and I think impactful to make sure that the reporting on these issues is not doing a disservice to citizen literacy on these issues. So that's why I think for me, I think Valentine's Day is first and foremost now this sort of opportunity for activism around same-sex marriage in Japan for the law reform that we're still working to gain. Because we're not there yet. And there is a, have there's been a whole movement in support of same-sex marriage, and there's I think I can't remember the exact number of companies, but certainly Enjoy Japan is one of those signing companies in, signing in support, and that's been a chambers of commerce with the LGBTQ Lawyers Alliance network in Japan, who's been at the forefront of really working, as well as other organizations, working on same-sex marriage as a core law reform issue to the family registry that we hope to see coming forward. In Japan, just for context, we have same-sex partnership registrations that are being allowed at the municipal level in certain cities across Japan. And there's been a flourishing of local municipalities who've said, we will allow same-sex couples to register their partnership, but it is not legally binding on nationally legislated family law. So it only has jurisdiction, if you will, jurisdictional impact and recognition within the municipality, which has major constraints because across Tokyo, people are commuting. You live in Nerima, but you work in Shibuya. You live in, Harajuku, but you work in Minatoku. Like, so having things that are not nationally recognized through family law means that there's really still legal gaps that are significant. And there's 30 million plus people in Tokyo. Like, this is a significant portion of the population of Japan. The size of Canada's population practically lives in Tokyo. So the governor of Tokyo has also initiated sort of a thought process around having a Tokyo-wide same-sex registration system, such that at least you would have jurisdictional coverage potentially Tokyo-wide, which would be really impactful in terms of elevating the rights of families in the whole Tokyo-wide 30 million people, but also reducing the disaster risk and the other legal risks that are constantly present for those families when they can't be seen and legally seen as family members.
And hopefully then that would trickle into the countryside and other smaller cities
Hopefully it'll
eventually.
trickle up to the national government, and hopefully that hopefully the Diet, the parliament, will finally legislate a reform to recognize that this has always been a part of Japan. This is not new, right? Queer folks have been in Japan since the beginning of time. It's been well written and documented about. It's not a new Western import, but it's just never been legally allowed to legally on record exist in Japan as a part of Japanese-ness. And that's a more that's a point of we need to see that the understanding of Japanese-ness and Japanese citizenship on record needs to pivot to say, yes, these identities and these parts of our society we embrace and include in the circle of Japanese-ness. And that's not happening at the legal and political level, unfortunately, even if the population en masse is supportive of same-sex marriage. So there's a real gap between what the political elite will allow through in terms of law reform, very conservative, and what the actual Japanese population says they are absolutely happy to have and support as part of Japanese society. It's a real gap in representative democracy. And so that's, as political scientists, we're looking at these gaps in representative democracy is not working if you're elite. And I don't know if that's an elite space, but certainly we think of it as an elite decision-making space is not following the wishes of the population on core issues of gender equality and LGBTQ inclusion. There's a gap, and it's not functionally making representation evolve through the actual laws of the country.
I love how you look at things. Like, it's so different than how I see them. Like, I don't think in governance and things like that, but I feel like I could talk to you for hours and ask you so many more questions and
I'm such a geek when it comes to talking about
It's just very
democracy.
different.
I get so excited, and people are like, "Seriously?" I'm like, "Yeah, 30 years on, I'm still excited about
Yeah,
it."
it's
You know, even if there's
awesome.
these disappointments, you know, constantly there's these disappointments, don't get me wrong, but I still hold out some hope that we can get there. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I love that you're living who you are and have found work in what you're passionate about. And I'll ask you if there's any last thing that you want to share with your people in Japan, your people anywhere that might be hearing this, like, is there any last thing that you want to share about yourself that you to feel like this is complete, this conversation for this moment? Because next
Right.
week you might have a whole nother coming out and
Right. Not so much about me, but I guess I certainly in my role as president of FEW Japan, which is this women's association in Japan, or a nonprofit, you know, we are explicitly holding space for queer women in that organization, and our board has been very clear in making that formally a part of our organization and association's values, officially on record since 2021 as a board decision. And we're calling on, you know, queer women across Japan who speak English and want to be a part of an English-speaking sort of progressive space to come and think about being a part of our community, because it is very much a woman-affirming, a diversity of women affirming queer positive association. So I'll put that invitation, I guess, to women in Japan to find us and join us. I think putting on my Enjoy Japan CEO hat and Enjoy Innovation CEO hat for companies that are struggling with these issues, and I work actually now a lot with national university system in Japan, but also universities in Canada. I think, you know, if they're looking for people who can help facilitate a democratic dialogue around these topics of diversity and LGBTQ issues and inclusion. We teach a lot about intersectional equity as a core foundation of how we build psychological safety in companies and help them sustain innovation also in their companies, because we need to have the 360 view on a problem. And you don't get that if you've all got the same usual suspects who all look the same and all graduated from the same universities and all are the same gender. You just don't get that. And so it's both a democratic imperative for me that organizations need to take up and see as a democratic imperative, and it's about intersectional equity. And both are good for profit margin, and both are good for productivity, and both are good for sustainable innovation. And both are good for workplace happiness and emotional safety at work. So, invitation to companies or universities that are looking for support. And our team is, we have a lovely team of diverse folks and interdisciplinary, really different backgrounds, different lived experiences, different countries, different mother tongues. We love to bring that diversity into the class, into sort of the learning room, and to be guides and to hold space for those kinds of recreating a circle of inclusion and equity, for those organizations looking for guides, that can help them hold space for the minority perspectives and keep it peaceful. Peaceful and productive and depolarized. Because we need different levels of analysis. You need the political analysis, you need the aggregate, data driven. This is generally what happens with, if you look at the data. This is the political bipolarization of the debates, but this is the aggregate, what actually happens in society in Canada or Japan, and what do people think about it? This is the diversity of views on the issues, and then this is sort of one that would be consistent with equity and emotional safety for all diverse folks. And I think everybody wants that. I think everybody wants emotional safety for everyone. I hope that's the case. If we can all align to that, I think that you can have a better discussion, a democratic discussion and dialogue that can allow for learning and lifelong learning, hopefully, in a peaceful and non-aggressive, but still trying to reveal the diversity of perspectives that might be getting in the way of mutual understanding.
Yeah, when you can drill down to we all want safety for people, then we can hear each other and
We can hear
find
each other,
that common ground somewhere down lower.
right? And if there are members in the room who don't actually care about the emotional safety of others, and I've been in those situations as a DEI consultant and educator in rooms where I've had to say, okay, consistently, that individual, constructively, purposefully now, is not being constructive, is purposefully now engaging in microaggression and power harassment, repeated track record. Not once, not twice, like repeated track record, and not only in the classroom, but outside of the classroom. And I've had to make decisions to say, we need to regulate this piece of conflict and this piece of toxicity that's happening, because it can be challenging for the rest of the people who now totally don't feel safe because one individual has decided that they're going to engage in power harassing tactics. And as a political scientist, the power issue is real, and we have to regulate the power in the room as well, eyes wide open, honestly. Or there's no emotional safety possible for the whole group. And that's hard. That's a really hard piece of this work on DEI. What is democratic discussion and debate and dialogue that's peaceful and emotionally safe versus what becomes aggression? Those boundaries are hard.
And I think if you could spend time and create a safe space for that problem person, it
Exactly.
would get to the bottom of like they're hurt somewhere, they have some kind of trauma, that
Absolutely.
that's what's speaking out, and they actually would want safety for everyone, but they've never experienced it or
Themselves.
something. So then,
They've
yeah,
never experienced themselves. And
that's.
so they go into, do you want to be bullied or do you want to be the bully? And that's the dialogue. That's the polarization they're trapped in, right? And so they're like, I'm going to be the bully. So how do we morph that individual as well, right? And sometimes it's coaching, and you would know a lot
Yeah,
about
I was going to say
that.
that's one of my favorite parts of my work is helping people grow in their own consciousness of like where are you stuck, where are you hitting up against a wound within yourself, and how can we heal that wound so that you're not on autopilot driven by that thing. And so
Driven and triggered, and then enacting violence towards other inadvertently. Sometimes maybe openly and aware, but unable to change behavior still, right? And I've, you see that too, where they're aware they have issues, they're trying to figure out what to do, but the behavioral shift doesn't, even if you cognitively know something, it doesn't automatically lead to behavioral change. And DEI is really meant to be about behavioral and cultural change within an organization. Not just simply cognitively knowing stuff, like I know the different unconscious biases, and that's enough. That's not going to ever be enough to change behavior. So practicing it really matters. And I think coaching is a beautiful opportunity for that transformation. And I think coaches like you doing that guiding is so pivotal. And I almost think if we could have, I mean, I almost think if we could have in every country, democratic country worldwide, there should be just like a part of public health care should be a coaching path, like money for coaching, money for personal development and coaching on any issue, any mental health issue, any psychological, any like anything that you need to have a coach on. And I know that I can imagine the certain political parties going, oh my goodness, that would cost a fortune, right? But think of the prevention it does in terms of long-term costs that we are paying for anyhow, out the wazoo in other ways as a society and as a democracy. We're paying for it one way or the other. I think if we could have it as a prevention,
Proactive,
I think that would be amazing.
yeah. Yeah, I love that. Well, here's for Jackie for president or prime minister or something.
Goodness. Yeah, so many things I think we could build the architecture for, right? Through law and good public policy. We'll see, right?
Yeah. Well, I
Lots
love
of
that you brought up family law and things today. Another guest we have coming on soon is going to talk about law in terms of reproductive law and surrogacy and things like that. And
Yes,
so that
awesome.
will be another good topic for
I
all
will
of
be
this.
tuning into that one too. That's great.
Yeah.
That's this is a Canadian context.
Yep.
That's fascinating. I happen to be a bird's eye view 23 years ago, I guess. I was doing research on the Liberal Women's Caucus, and that's the women parliamentarians, a part of the Liberal Party, who sit in Parliament in the House of Commons. And I was doing research on what the Liberal Women's Caucus, what their role is, what is their advocacy role within the Liberal Party caucus, within the Liberal Party, within changing law. And at that point in time in Canada, it was the first time we were in the middle of drafting, Minister Alan Rock was drafting the first piece of legislation on human-assisted reproduction. And it was really fascinating, and I documented in the articles that I wrote about that after, was just the role that the Liberal Women's Caucus played in asking the tough questions of the minister to say, like, how are we solving for these things? And it was really interesting to see that advocacy role that they had as an internal check on their own parliamentarians in their own caucus, and of the minister, to ask the minister to, have you dealt with this? Like, are you aware of these issues from a women's perspective, or from, queer women's perspective, or a lesbian women's perspective? And so it's, I'm excited to listen to that interview that you're going to have next, because I want to hear what they're going to say now, some 20 odd years later, that legislation has been put in place. Where are the gaps still? Are there other gaps, and what are they, and what can we be doing differently and better as a democracy? So I will be tuning in.
I love it. Well, thank you for being here with us and sharing your wisdom, and I've learned a lot, and we'll keep the conversations going.
Opportunity to think and be guided on this question, because I was looking for who I wanted to have this conversation with and who I thought could like guide me and have the right questions to, and to, I don't know, hold space for it. And you popped up on the radar, and I saw your podcast, and I thought, that's who I want to have this conversation with for sure. So thank you for that. I really appreciate it. You gave me a lot of emotional security and safety to talk today. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Coming Out Chronicles. If you enjoyed it, give it a like. And if you think it would be helpful for someone else, please share it with them. If you'd like to connect with me, reach out on social. I'd love to support you on the next chapter of your coming out story. Until next time, this is Nancy Shadlock from Centered Life Coaching.